Meeting the food needs of a growing global population is a challenge, and climate change will make it even more difficult. That's according to the U.S. Global Change Research Program's fourth National Climate Assessment Report. The report finds that rising temperatures, extreme heat, drought, and heavy downpours are expected to increasingly disrupt agricultural productivity in the United States. The report also warns that expected increases in challenges to livestock health, declines in crop yields and quality, and changes in extreme events in the United States and abroad threaten rural livelihoods, sustainable food security, and price stability. It all sounds pretty dire, but innovations in how and where we grow our food can help. Joining us to talk about hydroponic growing is Dr. Neil Matson. He's at the School of Integrative Plant Science and Horticulture at Cornell University. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
And on the phone, we have Paul Salou, who's founder and CEO of Little Leaf Farms, that's growing lettuces hydroponically in New England. Welcome to you.
Great to be with you.
Hydroponic growing in different forms has been around for thousands of years. Neil, explain how hydroponic growing works.
Sure. So hydroponics is delivering to the plant the things that the root zone needs without growing the plants in soil. So you deliver nutrients in a water solution that the roots are bathed in, and then you also supply oxygen, which the roots need to respire.
Paul, what are the components to your hydroponic system?
Yeah, so our hydroponic system contains a reservoir with nutrient solution, and then it has channels that lettuce or other leafy greens are planted in, and then the nutrient solution is recirculated and monitored and adjusted over time.
So, Paul, what nutrients are necessary for growing your hydroponic lettuces, and where do those sources of nutrients come from?
We use all the nutrients that the plant needs. I mean, people usually are familiar with the big three, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, but there's a whole array of micronutrients, and we supply those. So everything that the plant needs to grow, we supply to make sure we grow healthy, nutritious plants.
What kind of waste, if any, is generated in hydroponic growing?
Well, we grow in a substrate called stone wool, which is made from the basalt rock, and we're in the process of switching to a peat moss substrate. So, the roots, the stalk, and the substrate, that is basically, a byproduct of hydroponic growing after harvest. And what we do is we separate that and send that to a commercial composter, and then they recycle that and return that back as a compost-based soil amendment.
And Neil, is that pretty much standard when you're growing hydroponically?
That's correct, yeah. So there are some type of physical substrate that the roots are usually, or the plant is germinated in, and then that can be a material that is typically composted and recycled. And then the nice thing about capturing and reusing the nutrient solution is that there's not wasted water or fertilizer.
Neil, how does energy consumption in hydroponics compare with energy consumption of traditional growing methods?
Yeah, so this is actually one of the things we've studied pretty closely at Cornell University. And we looked at some different scenarios for growing lettuce in a greenhouse in New York City, or we also looked at the scenario of growing it in a warehouse farm, and compared that to field production, which typically happens in Salinas, California, or Yuma, Arizona, and shipped 3,000 miles. So when we compared greenhouses to field production, it was about on par, actually. So the heating cost of a greenhouse and the lighting cost can be substantial, although those are going down over time as we implement renewable energy or LED lighting. But it's about the greenhouse footprint of growing lettuce in a greenhouse on the East Coast was about on par of growing in a field and shipping 3,000 miles in the scenarios that we looked at.
And now when we compare the carbon footprint associated with growing and shipping vegetables the traditional way with hydroponic growing, how do they compare?
That's right. So traditional vegetables, the transportation cost ends up being the largest contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. But it turns out that overall that was on par with greenhouse production in the East Coast because of our need to heat and add supplemental light.
So what is the journey that lettuces or greens take when they're grown in California, Florida, or Mexico, you mentioned Arizona, to supermarkets in the Northeast? And how long does a trip like that take?
Sure. Paul, do you want to take a stab at that first?
Sure. Well, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, over 95% of all the leafy greens are grown in Salinas, California, and Yuma, Arizona. So if you're living in the East Coast, they're traveling over 3,000 miles, which takes a number of days and to get to a distribution center. And then from there, it's redistributed to the actual grocery store or restaurant. So multiple days, you know, 6, 7, 8, even 9 days, subject to weather and everything else, right? So that's why, you know, we've been successful because we're growing locally and delivering everything in a 24-hour time period and just delivering, therefore, fresher, more nutritious, higher quality product. Mm-hmm.
And what about the cost? Is the cost of the lettuces, how it compares with the lettuces grown outside of New England?
Well, I mean, what we're focused on is, basically we're competing against the West Coast product delivered 3,000 miles mm-hmm. from California and Arizona. So we're comparable. So, based on them growing outside and us growing in a greenhouse, the cost of production, it's higher in a greenhouse, but we're focused on the East Coast, and you can't grow, obviously, year-round here, and people eat mm-hmm. lettuce year-round. So with a notion of controlled environment and greenhouses, you control year-round, and we're comparable delivered against the California product. Yeah.
Paul, you mentioned peat, and there's been concerns about the use of peat because it's storing a lot of carbon dioxide. Is it sustainable to use peat as a growing medium?
Well, if you talk to the Canadians and the Europeans and the bogs that are up there, I mean, remember, peat is derived from a live living plant, the sphagnum moss. So it all depends on sort of how the peat bogs are managed. But from I've been told by the peat companies that we buy from, because sustainability is very important to us, that there's enough bogs that are undisturbed. So whatever they take out of the bogs there, they're removing peat from, that the net effect is that there is more peat being generated from the new bogs than peat being removed. Mm. But I think it's a bog by bog type scenario. And for us, it's very important to buy from a supplier that is operating their business in a sustainable way.
Mm. And Paul, does hydroponic growing of lettuces reduce water consumption when compared to lettuces grown in the ground?
That's the big advantage. So we capture all the water that falls on our roof, so we don't even have a well, and that goes into a lined basin. We use between 90% to 95% less water than is generally used in field agriculture.
Neil, in general, does hydroponic growing of most vegetables require less water than the soil-grown crops?
That's correct. Yeah, so hydroponic growing is more water use efficient because you're recirculating the nutrients and the water, and you're not letting it fall onto the soil.
What about the structure? Are plants grown hydroponically different structurally than plants grown in the soil?
Sometimes we found that plants have a more tender taste when grown in a greenhouse. Outdoors, you have to, in a sense, kind of make a tougher plant that can withstand the environmental extremes. So the consumers that I've talked to kind of prefer the more tender taste of greenhouse vegetables.
And do they grow or mature differently than the plants grown in the soil, or is it similar?
Overall, the plant life cycle is very similar. It often takes place much more quickly in a greenhouse, though, because we can optimize the temperature and light conditions that the plant receives.
So the sun doesn't shine every day.
Right. Yep.
Paul, how do you control pests?
Yeah, so
I mean, there's... Go ahead, Neil.
Sure. There are... insect and disease issues that can occur in the greenhouse just like outdoors. The great thing about a greenhouse is you can control the environment and you can actually try to exclude the pests through screening. There are commercially available beneficial insects that are used to control the harmful insects that we don't want. And there are also beneficial microbes that can be used to control disease organisms.
Is that how you do it, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, we have insects that are herbivores that like to eat our lettuce. And so what we do is we use biological control. We don't use any chemical sprays and haven't from day one, pesticides, fungicides, herbicides. Have never used them, never will. So we put in carnivorous insects, and those insects eat the so-called bad bugs that like our lettuce. So that biological control maintains balance in the greenhouse, and which is what happens naturally in nature. And done correctly, you can completely eliminate the use of chemical sprays. Hmm.
So how long does it take to grow your lettuces? And what is that time frame between harvest and the arrival in the grocery store shelf?
We're harvesting, in the 20 to 25 day period. So we call it a baby lettuce. And we're cutting lettuce today at our Devens, Massachusetts facility. That will be, as in a restaurant or a store potentially today or no later than tomorrow.
Mm. Neil, what other vegetables or fruits could be grown hydroponically? And then how do the costs of doing that so compare with them, growing them traditionally?
Yes, so the most common hydroponic vegetable we consume in the U.S. is actually tomatoes. So the majority of fresh tomatoes that Americans eat are grown in greenhouses, either in the U.S. or also Mexico and Canada have large greenhouse tomato industries. Some of the other common vegetables are cucumbers and peppers and eggplant. And then besides lettuce and leafy greens, herbs and for basil, for example, are commonly grown hydroponically.
Neil, is it possible to scale hydroponic growing to meet the needs of large urban areas?
Yeah, so that's one of the things we've been looking at in a National Science Foundation funded project. And one of the things that we found is greenhouse production is very high density, high yielding. So if we look at lettuce, for example, we can get 20 to 50 times the output per acre as we do in field production.
So what are some of innovative ways then that hydroponic growing could be to set up to get maximum yield?
Yeah, a lot of it is about environmental management. So if you can optimize the temperature and lighting conditions, you can really push the plant to complete its life cycle as quickly as possible. And then that gives you more than a dozen crop cycles per year for leafy greens in a greenhouse. Mm.
Paul, how labor intensive is hydroponics and what are the staffing requirements that you have?
Well, our growing system, right now we're 5 acres under glass, moving to 10 acres with our new facility currently under construction. So we're automated in the seeding and growing and harvesting. So, we need growers and people like that involved, but we don't need actual physical labor. So, our employees are basically in our packaging area, truck driving, sales, marketing, all of that. So, we're employing approaching 60 people, but very, very few people, except for the growers, are actually involved within inside the greenhouse itself.
Mm-hmm. Neil, is that sort of seem the norm for other growers?
That's correct. We see different sizes of operations, and some of the small operations that maybe sell to restaurants or at farmers markets might use more manual labor and not be as well automated. And then we see as operations scale up to become these larger operations, it's important to automate as much as possible, which still means you need an educated workforce to the mechanics to maintain the greenhouse, the growers to monitor the crop and deploy biological controls, for example. But there is some labor savings associated with that automation.
Well, in our greenhouse, we grow in what is called a mobile gutter, which actually moves through the greenhouse and has a number of seeds and plants growing in it. So, as the plant moves through the greenhouse, which again is very different than field agriculture, where basically you plant it in the soil and it stays there. But because we're very concerned about space efficiency, we can space the plants only when the plants need spacing, so then we can maximize the amount of plants per square foot per square meter. Mm. And then as the gutters come out of the greenhouse for harvesting, they go into a cutting machine where the product is cut. So it's all part of a sophisticated material handling system that we've incorporated in our greenhouse. Hmm.
And now I'm asking Neil, but maybe Paul, you want to chime in on this too. I'm just thinking about real estate costs and how much square footage you might need for some of this hydroponic growing. Is this something, Neil, that we see becoming more popular? I'm thinking about the cost factor of the real estate for these greenhouses.
Yeah, in some of our own analysis of the economics of like urban production, we found that there's kind of a sweet spot that's maybe 50 to 100 miles outside of a city center where you are still very close to the population centers, but land is more affordable, and then you have access to the utilities that you need and the road system that you need.
Yeah. Paul, what are your thoughts on that?
Completely agree. The term Neil's colleague coined is called peri-urban. Lou Albright, and I'm a big proponent of that. So basically the perimeter of these urban markets, I mean, we're literally about 42 miles outside of downtown Boston. So, you know, that amount of distance against most major cities in North America, I mean, you're in the suburbs or you're in the country. Yeah. So you're really kind of returning this land, which traditionally fed the cities. But now you're returning to do its same job, but using technology, you know, and very different than obviously than our forefathers did.
And can you grow vertically?
That's one of the things that we've looked at Cornell as well. So there are warehouse farms, for example, where you have multiple racks of plant growing. That turns out to be more energy intensive than a greenhouse because we don't have natural sunlight. So that has about twice the carbon footprint of a greenhouse or field growing. And in a greenhouse, it's not really considered practical to grow on multiple levels because on average, the sun over the course of a year gives us about enough light to grow one layer of crop.
We'll post more information about hydroponic growing, including more about Dr. Neil Matson's research and Little Leaf Farms at our website, capeandislands.org. Dr. Neil Matson from Cornell University and Paul Salo from Little Leaf Farms, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Yep. Thank you.
Thanks also to Glenn Palmer at Cornell University for production assistance. Coming up after a break, combining aquaculture and hydroponics. It's called aquaponics, and it could be the future of farming across the globe. You're listening to The Point. Aquaponics is a food production system that combines agriculture, raising fish or other marine organisms in tanks, with hydroponics. The relationship between the plants and animals is symbiotic. Aquaponics uses 90% less water than conventional farming, so it's a growing movement in Colorado where years of drought have made people view the resource differently. In this next piece from H2O Radio, we visit three locations using the method for the same, yet very different reasons.
There's an old black and white photograph in the lobby of Gavin Witt's Colorado Springs warehouse. It's of his great-grandparents who emigrated from Czechoslovakia and homesteaded in O'Neill, Nebraska. His family still farms that land, and growing food is in his blood, too. But you won't find him out on a tractor tilling the soil.
Rather, you'll find him here, checking water temperatures and adjusting lights. And instead of the sound of irrigation, you'll hear the humming of pumps and aerators. His company, Daily Harvest, does aquaponics, which is a fusion of aquaculture, raising fish in a controlled environment, and hydroponics, which is cultivating plants in water. Fish waste provides a food source for the plants, and the plants filter the water for the fish to live in.
Well, come on out. If you will, just wipe your feet onto the mat there.
A tour of Daily Harvest starts in a room with over a dozen blue tanks measuring about 10 feet in diameter. We wipe our feet on a disinfectant mat to ensure biosecurity. We peer in the tank windows and see fish maybe 12 inches long swimming round and round.
Here we've got tilapia in here as well as a couple koi, roughly 150 in the first tank, 150 in the second tank. 250. These are striped bass.
The choice of which fish to raise correlates to what plants he intends to grow.
It's kind of a balance because the high end of what the vegetables like, they like it in between 65, 68 degrees. We're on the kind of the low end tolerance level for the fish. So we kind of make a compromise between what the fish really, really like and what the vegetables really like.
We follow Gavin through a trail of PVC pipes into the adjoining room filled with rows and rows of grow beds with heads of romaine, bok choy, kale, and Swiss chard. Gavin lifts one of the lids to reveal a massive tangle of roots draping in the water.
When the crops are ready, they'll be delivered to the customer within hours of being cut. a contrast from the way much of our food is currently delivered.
You know, California provides, I think, 50% of the nation's fruit, nut, and vegetable produce. They have to harvest it before it's ready so that it can kind of mature on a truck somewhere, and then it comes to the local markets, and then it's got to sit there for another day or two before it's purchased, and then it sits in your lettuce crisper or whatever. So it's already, you know, I would assume 7 days old.
Many fruits and vegetables travel hundreds, if not thousands of miles to your fridge, and that means a lot of fuel and energy.
And unless they've been grown organically, they've probably been exposed to pesticides, which is another selling point for Daily Harvest. Aquaponics by design is organic. If Gavin has a pest problem, he has to use biological controls because most chemicals are toxic to fish.
Gavin's dad comes into the tank area. Daily Harvest is a family affair. His father feeds the fish, and his mom and wife tend the plants. His father, Gary, is clearly proud of his son, who seemingly has left nothing to chance and no stone unturned.
It's pretty fun, you know. We had the sheriff out, proactively, because these lights, you turn these lights on at night,
yes,
in that warehouse, and they glow.
Yes.
We wanted the sheriff to know we were growing lettuce.
As opposed to
the marijuana or pot, you know.
One sheriff's department that wouldn't need any introduction to aquaponics is the Denver County Jail, which is about 75 miles north of the Daily Harvest facility. The Denver Sheriff's Department launched a pilot program early in 2014.
After going through 4 locked doors, we're standing in what was once a dormitory at the jail. Deputies Hazel Pablo and Jeff Bush are proudly showing us their fish tank and grow beds. It's a modest system compared to Daily Harvest, and right now only feeds the officers. But they have high hopes to expand the program.
Well, we'd like the jail to become more sustainable and be able to feed our inmate population and reducing costs of shipping the food and carbon waste.
Aquaponics uses about 90% less water than conventional farming and only needs occasional water to replace what's lost to evaporation.
So it's constantly water being moved around in the system and nothing is wasted. Most of the water inside the tanks are the original water that we started with last year.
The energy and water savings are only part of the benefit. The jail sees the potential to provide inmates training.
We give the inmates a lot of responsibility, and this would give them relaxed time from their responsibility in the dorms and give them a different set of responsibility, something they could look forward to, something that they would find educational, something they could put on the resume.
As we stand with the officers listening to the gurgling of the water and watching the fish swim, it has a soothing, if not mesmerizing, effect. People are drawn to aquaponics for a variety of reasons. The local food movement, water and energy savings, being able to grow food all year round without fertilizers or pesticides. For others, though, the value of aquaponics in terms of food security and its social benefits is immeasurable.
You take a seed, a lettuce seed, and you stick it in that water, and you put fish in that water, and in 3 to 4 weeks, you see that seed turn into a head of lettuce. I mean, it's no words to describe how gratifying that is.
That's Charles Hendricks. He's the founder and director of the nonprofit Abundant Harvest Community Outreach in Fountain, Colorado. We're standing in his 30 by 100-foot hoop house, and although it's December and 40 degrees outside, it's hot in here.
He started his aquaponics nonprofit that provides food to the poor after the Great Recession of 2008 sunk his sports memorabilia company.
Feeling sorry for myself. Best way to get over that is to do something for somebody else.
So he worked at the food pantry at his local church. After seeing the same people come in day after day, week after week, he got the idea to start an aquaponics system on land borrowed from the church, with the idea to grow food by and for the community.
Because to Charles, aquaponics is more than farming food efficiently. It's about planting seeds of opportunity. It's about strengthening relationships and networks. It's a teaching tool.
Talking about teaching them to fish, you're teaching them to know how to fish and how to make the fish and everything. for us in what we do to use this concept. Sustainability is gathering information, passing it on to people, giving them a choice.
So in other words, give a man a fish and he eats for a day. Teach a man aquaponics, and not only can he feed himself, but maybe his entire community for life.
That piece came to us from H2O Radio. We'll post a link with more information about aquaponics, including links to Cape Farms using a variation of aquaponics, at our website, capeandislands.org.